We're going to look at Solomon tonight. So if someone could, if they would give me a guess, we could play Price is Right. So the closest to the actual number without going over would win. What is the value of a human heart? What is the value, the monetary value in U.S. dollars or British pounds, depending on your persuasion? What is the value of a human heart? Like, I need your heart. I'm going to pay you for it. How much is it worth? $500. $495,000. You went over. Closest to the actual price. No, Adam knows because we talked about it. But let me just say this. I'm going to go ahead and throw him under the bus. He was very underbid. One-tenth of what it was worth. So a human heart is worth $539,155 or 425,000 British pounds. That's what a human heart is worth. It is the most costly organ that you could donate, technically. I mean, if you donate in that, you're done, you know. You can go without a kidney, and you can go without an eye or two if you want. But, yeah, you can't really go without your heart. So the value of your heart is that's what we put a monetary price on it. But if you think about it, what does God want? God wants your heart. He doesn't care whether you really can see or you can walk or you have hair or no hair. He just wants your heart. And how valuable is that to him? And sometimes we're going to see that tonight. We lose sight of what that is. And one thing that we need to do is to guard our hearts. And we've heard that, but this is the key. When you have something that's valuable, what do? You guard it, don't you? That big safe right there, I love that thing. Because think about it. What is behind that is something that is so valuable. We put a huge door, all kinds of locks so that nothing can get to it. So our value, the heart that we have, is extremely valuable to God. And we underprice it way too much, don't we? And we give it away to other things so quickly sometimes. It's like $5 sometimes. All right, so let's look at then. We're going to look at our first thing on Solomon. We're going to look at the fact that he had a really good example in his father, right? The redeeming aspect, I think, is interesting that who was Solomon's mom? Does anybody know?
Bathsheba.
Isn't that kind of interesting? There was some redemption in that, I think, the fact that her son, who wasn't the oldest, right? Okay, was the one that was picked to be the king. I think it's interesting how God maybe used that to redeem that relationship, if you will. So so Solomon gets to be king, right? There was some controversy that had to go through before he was anointed and appointed king, but he was appointed the king by his dad, David. And here's what he said. Somebody read for me 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 3. 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 3. So David gives a charge to Solomon, doesn't he? Right? He presents him with, he's on his deathbed. He's saying, this is it. This is the key to everything in life. And what is it? Obedience. Keep the law. Keep the statutes. Walk in them. It is all about obedience. David is trying to stress to Solomon, look, you have got to have an obedient heart if you want to have success. That may look different. It may not be money necessarily, but success in life in a spiritual way. So he's telling him, you've got to be obedient. You don't have a choice. You have got to be obedient if you want for this Christian life to work. If you want for this, the leadership that he's going to take on. Now, Solomon was like 20 years old. Who in here is 20? Anybody 20? 21, 22, 23. Are you ready to be king? I'm not ready for you to be king, trust me, right? But imagine a young man getting that advice from David. Now, he spent all this time growing up, right, and with David being his dad and being the king, and so he did have some instruction into probably how he could do things, and I'm sure he had to take classes just like other kids, and he had to learn diplomacy and all those things that probably rolled into that. But the key that David said is you must be obedient to God's word, God's law, God's commandments, and you must walk in them. Now, I think it's interesting he says walk in them, not know them, but walk. Because knowledge is going to play a big part in Solomon's life, isn't it? But did David say you need to really know them all, have them memorized? No, he said you need to walk in these things. You need to be obedient. Your heart has got to be an obedient heart. So the next one we're going to look at is the fact that his heart was one that he said is a hearing heart. In our study, it talked about that. Someone read for me 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 9. Okay, before we go any further, remember what's going on? In a dream, God comes to Solomon and says what? Ask what you want. Whatever you want, ask me. And he says what? Read that again for me. Yeah, right there again.
Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this?
Okay, young man, and in our study, it said, what was it that, why did that please God? It said that it pleased him that that's what he asked for. The key, I think, is this. He asked for an understanding heart, didn't he? Now, he wanted an understanding heart. If you look at the word and you start looking at that word understanding, there's several different meanings. Some translations say a receptive heart. That he asked for a receptive heart. I like that word. Because receptive means what? You're going to receive. Not only are you going to receive, but I want to receive understanding and how to judge. He wanted to receive instruction. Now that is everybody's big problem, isn't it? How many of you have ever tried to put something together for your kids or your brother or your sister and you had no instructions? Or you had the instructions, but you put them away, right? Because I'm a man and it's a bicycle. Come on. It can't be that hard, right? No. Isn't that amazing? And then you get through and you're like, I got extra pieces and I don't know what they go to. One time I did a class and I would take these little Lego kits. And we would take these little Lego kits that had all the pieces, and we would hand them out into groups, and we'd say, all right, now, put this together. Well, what is it? Well, we can't tell you, but put it together. Well, what does it look like? You're just going to have to, you've got everything there, everything you need, just put it together. And it was amazing because nothing looked like ever what it was supposed to be. And then we'd show the picture, and it'd be like a little helicopter or something. You know, if you are not receptive of instruction, what you put together will never match what God wants. It's never going to look the same. It's never going to look like him. It's going to just simply be what you create on your own. And most of the times, we will take the pieces, forget the instruction because we don't have a receptive heart, and then when we build something and it falls apart or it's in shambles, and then we go, God, it's your fault. You gave me this thing, and look. And the whole time, he's saying, if you had just looked at my word and been receptive and taken instruction, none of this would have happened. And you can hear David trying to get this point across to Solomon. You've got to follow God's instructions on how to live. You've got to do it. Because David had some examples in his own life when he didn't and what happened. You know, and what's amazing for me is that even in failure, David was obedient. Because he immediately repented when it was brought to him, and it was a true repentance. Even in that, he was obedient to God. And so when we fail to have a reception of when we don't receive God's instructions well, when we don't apply that, because there's a difference between hearing and doing, isn't there? We have all probably been raised around church. Most of us have. I have. I knew it, but I didn't do it. I had a knowledge of God's word, but I didn't obey it. Again, that obedient heart, that receptive heart, those things, everything comes into that together. Now, a modern term which I kind of like is called being coachable. Okay, this has been thrown around. I coached Little League for a long time, and that was the award that I loved to give out to that little guy who went up to bat at that T-ball and struck out at T-ball. And then you try to instruct him, and you coach him, and you know what? The first time he hits it, his face lights up, and he runs to third base, you know? But it's amazing, though, how when someone is coachable, what they can accomplish. So let me show a quick video of Larry Fitzgerald.
In his 14th NFL season, Larry Fitzgerald still needs to know it all.
Where's he from, coach? What's the next play? What's the next one, coach? What's after this? Hold on, what's this route? I'm blocking the man over me, right?
Z or X on MP. What am I? I'm asking you, what am I playing?
When Fitzgerald came into the league in 2004, the question being asked was, why did Arizona draft him?
The Cardinals had the third overall pick that year, and a lot of us thought they needed a quarterback.
4 years earlier, he'd been a ball boy for Dennis Green's Minnesota Vikings. Now, Dennis Green was his head coach.
Larry, after you catch it, at least 4 or 5 steps of burst.
There was some criticism, you know, of course, the experts out there that thought that perhaps Denny Green was too close to Larry Fitzgerald. But Denny was absolutely convinced that Larry Fitzgerald was going to be a Pro Bowl player and play for a long, long time.
I had already solidified myself as a dominant player in the National Football League, and I kind of felt at times that, you know, he didn't respect that about me, but that was just me being young. I think he saw that I had potential to do more and be better than I saw myself at that point.
Todd Haley said, you catch the ball, you fall down on the ground. You need to be more like Anquan Boldin. Anquan catches the ball and suddenly turns into a raging bull. You need to do the same thing.
I just took it personal and I said, you know what, I'm going to prove him wrong.
Caught Fitzgerald, 10-5, dies. Fitzgerald is going to be in.
I had the conversation with him that I'm not here to be your friend, but in the end, I hope you'll respect me when we're high-fiving over top of them.
For someone, can be rewarding. It also can be a challenge. In 2013, Bruce Arians became the Cardinals' head coach. One of his first decisions was to move Larry Fitzgerald from a split end to a slot receiver.
I felt like it was a slight initially. Like he doesn't think I'm good enough to do this anymore. He's trying to run me out. You know, those type of thoughts go to your mind.
We moved him into the slot receiver. You know, he had a ton of questions because he did not want to fail.
You didn't like the way I ran there?
I thought it was a little flat because that made you chop your feet too much.
And he was afraid of making that transition because it was totally, totally new to him. As we grew together, there were very, very rough spots.
Larry, break in! Why'd you break out?
Of me on
there. Oh man, breaking you might score. They cleared the whole middle out.
He saw where it was heading. You know, I said, hey, call Reggie, call Hines. They got 80, 90 balls later in their career. You still got years left.
I talked to Hines Ward and I talked to Reggie Wayne. And both of them told me the same thing. I want you to let him know and you show him that you are completely committed to what he's doing.
So explain it one more time to me, coach. So it's going to be Trout right.
FBL. 70 go.
Then things are going to look good for you.
Instead of lining up outside the numbers, running deep patterns and relying on his jumping ability, Fitzgerald was now running more shallow crossing routes in the congested middle of the field and exposing himself to more big hits.
He used to joke that being in the slot, getting banged up, having guys hit you, running short slants, that's Anquan Boldin's job. It became Larry Fitzgerald's job.
I think it is the strongest argument for him being a Hall of Famer. Not only the great things he did, But he was asked to sacrifice. He was asked to do things he wasn't particularly comfortable with. He wasn't even that good in the slot his first year. But man, did he improve.
You know, and there's times I'm watching him on film, not catching passes, but going in and blocking a safety. You know, things that he didn't want to have any part of 7-8 years ago.
He probably has become the best blocking wide receiver in the National Football League right now.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. That's block, baby. Yeah, yeah.
He is a pit bull in there. They use him like a pulling guard. He is a difference maker blocking from the wide receiver position. There's only a handful of people that you could ever say that about.
20 to the 15 to the 10 to the 5. And Fitz is in for the touchdown.
Boy, Fitz with a great block downfield.
He pancaked that boy.
He's as good as anybody because he cares, because he takes it just as serious as he does his route running, his catching. He does the dirty work.
He does the dirty work without playing dirty.
There was one play, he had a blindside hit on me. He could have killed me. He could have, like, bam, pretty much put me out the game. And he made the block. He deep-cleated me and all that. It was an effective block.
Fitzgerald just leveled Richard Sherman.
For what he could have done, you know what I mean, it was pretty much a nothing hit. But then he comes up and apologizes. Most people, you take that shot. You take your shot. Bang.
So he's coachable. That's why he's so good. Even when he doesn't like it, right? Even when the instruction is something that he doesn't want, you know. So Solomon was that point where he had to be coachable. He had to receive instruction. He knew that. And that's what he asked God for. I want to know. I want knowledge. But I want knowledge to what? To be able to judge what's good and evil. And then, you know, in the story, we have that the one that everybody knows about, the two children. One of them's dead and the other one's not. And the moms come and he makes this great judgment call and knows what to say and what to do and to make the right decision. And that spreads. And it said that his wisdom was so great. In other words, he was, I mean, everybody heard about this guy. He was famous. The Queen of Sheba came to ask him questions. I want to know. I've heard of your fame. I want to know, is it real? And it was. He had all the head knowledge you could imagine. He named all. It was amazing how much stuff he knew. In fact, God said that there's nobody that's known anymore since him. Now, it's amazing to me that he had all of this knowledge, but what was going on? He was building wealth. Things were going. The temple was built. Gold everywhere, onlay. If you look, listen to the instructions of how these things were built, it's amazing the amount of things that he was able to build with his knowledge, with that understanding. But if we look, there's some dangers and detours that come up in his life, right? Just like everyone else, we all have these things that we have to be careful of, because if we don't have an obedient heart, we will go astray. Someone read first. Kings, I think it's 11:1. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1.
But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites.
He loved many foreign women. Now, was that what God wanted? Wasn't it? It was specifically said, do not intermarry or even associate with foreigners in that sense. God did not want him to do that. Now, Gary and I have kind of done the math on some of the women. It's crazy. 700 wives? That kind of makes you question if he was the smartest guy, right? 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's a lot of women. What did that do? It divided his heart, didn't it? It divided his heart. And he started going and literally worshiping false gods. And I mean, some of these gods that they talk about, I mean, it's amazing that you're just like, really? I mean, most of us will go, well, we're not really going to go out and worship Satan. We're not going to literally do that, right? Well, it got to that point where that's basically what he was doing. Moloch, you know, the female goddess to Baal. I mean, and you think, oh, how did he get to that point? You know, all this is going on. Understand, I think this was a gradual thing. You had one more wife. You had one more concubine. You had one more wife, two more wives. Some of that, you know, I can justify that this is diplomacy, right? This is legal, you know. It's not against the law, so even though it's against Moses' law, you're going to justify things. So this was kind of a gradual process because his heart was dull. His hearing was dull. There was a quote out of the study that I really liked. It said that when we stay too long, when we start to listen to the voices of the world for too long, our hearing becomes dull. Our hearing becomes dull. In other words, we just don't hear it. Just don't hear it. You know, we live in the house across the street, and there's a train that comes by like 18 times a day. But after a while, you stop hearing it. And I remember growing up as a kid, my grandmother and grandfather had a house that literally was on the other side of the tracks. I guess it would be the good side, if you want to call it that. And the trains would come by, and we would go stay with their house. But, you know, after a while, I didn't even notice the trains because I was used to the noise. I got used to that noise, and it dulled my hearing for what was going on. Today is my oldest son's birthday. He turned 28. 28 years old. That makes you feel old, yes. But I'll never forget because about 20 years ago, I was working with a band called Taproot, and we were on one of the Ozfest tours, and it's a big, giant stadium-type tour things. When there were 22 bands, and none of them were, well, except for one, were believers. I'm talking like Pantera, Slipknot. I don't know if you know any of these names. You're probably in trouble. So I spent the entire summer, like 3 months, with these guys. And the band I had were luckily decent guys. But at one point, we were in St. Louis, Missouri, and we were going to Kansas City, Missouri. And I had my oldest son come on, and he was going to ride with us that little short trip across Missouri. And so he comes out, and we, you know, go to the hotel, and we're swimming, we're having fun, and it's time for us to leave. So I pack his little bag, we go, we get on the, you know, $450,000 tour bus, which 20 years ago was really nice. We get him in there, and he gets situated and goes back to the back, and he's, you know, playing Nintendo with, you know, the rock stars and has no idea who they are. And we spend a little bit of time that it's time to go, so I go out, and I'm unhooking all this stuff and putting the generator back up and all that kind of neat stuff. And he's just kind of sitting up in the driver's chair, you know, like a 10-year-old because he was 10, you know, pretending to drive. And I get on the bus, and we're getting ready to kind of head out, and everybody else is too. 22 bands, which is about 35 buses, all lined up, right? And he looks at me and says something. I'll never forget. He goes, "Dad, is this the world?" And I mean, wow. Out of the mouths of children, right? At some point, I guess he had been learning some stuff in Sunday school about the difference between the world and our world and things like that. And I thought, I have been around this for months. It just blew me away that I'm like, yeah, this is the world. You know, he was seeing all these guys that were partying and getting on buses and getting ready to go to the next town to do the show. And I'm just like, wow, God, I really have become dull in that hearing, you know? And it just amazed me how simple little steps kind of build up and build up and build up. And we've all probably experienced that at some point in our lives. We understand that, you know, that spiral of degradation that we all kind of have experienced in our life. And what does that look like? And how does that feel? And once we've gone down it, we have to get to the very bottom sometimes to be able to look up and to cry out to God. And I was thinking of that today, and I was like, wow, that spiral. And I don't know if you've ever been to a lighthouse, but in Pensacola, Florida, there's a lighthouse there. And I remember with my oldest son again. We were going up to the lighthouse. We looked at it, and as we were coming down, it's a spiral staircase. Going up at the steps are pretty wide because you're on the outside. But when you're going down, you have to be on the inside of the step to go down, and they're a lot smaller. And I mean, I was scared because it's like, I wasn't blind at the time. I had great depth perception. I'm thinking, and I'm looking straight down. I don't know how many stories it was, but it was a long way. And I was just like, whoa, if I misstep because these things are so small, I'm going to be just spiraling down. And that was kind of the picture that I got in my head as to what happens when we just take small step after small step downward, and we don't realize sometimes how dull our hearing is. And then it goes back to the fact that we may have a lot of head knowledge, but we're not doing it. We're not being obedient. And if you look at the very end of this, what does David really, or Solomon, learn, right? We know that he pursued absolutely everything that you could pursue in life. He had all the money he could have, all the women he could have, all the great food. He did absolutely everything beyond measure. And at the end of it, what did he say? It's nothing. It's worthless. It's absolutely worthless. So you look at that and you say, here's a guy who had it all, literally had it all. And he threw all of it away. His heart, he just threw it away. Like it wasn't even worth anything. Here comes another foreign wife. I'll just go worship this god. I'll just have this idol in my life. His heart to him was just not worth anything. So he gets to the point where he says what? We need to guard it. Because he's at the end of this, and he knows what it is. Somebody read for me Proverbs chapter 4, verses 20 through 27. I need someone loudly to do it. Proverbs 4, 20 through 27.
My son, attend to my words, incline thy ear unto my sayings. Let them not depart from thine eyes. Keep them in the midst of thine heart, for they are life. Those that find them, and health to all their flesh. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Put away from thee a froward mouth and perverse lips, put far from thee. Let thine eyes look right on, and let thine eyelids look straight before thee. Ponder the path of thy feet, and let all thy ways be established. Turn not to the right hand, nor to the left, remove thy foot from evil.
Verse 23. Somebody read verse 23.
Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life.
Watch your heart. Guard your heart. It is so valuable that God himself sacrificed Jesus Christ, who was definitely worth more than $539,155. He sacrificed Jesus Christ because that's how valuable our heart is to him. And Solomon's saying, guard it, watch it, because out of it is, that's it. That is life. That is everything. It's life. So guarding our heart against all those things that we will put in front of Jesus and put in front of God so easily sometimes, you know? And it amazes me how quickly I can do that sometimes. And I think, wow, you know? Wow, I really need to guard it. I need to protect it. I need to make sure that it's worth some more to me than it has been in the past. And how do I do that? What did he say? Be obedient. Just be obedient to the word. Boy, that is so simple, isn't it? Simple, isn't it? Is it easy? That's right. So it's simple, but it's not easy because we have this stinking flesh. And even if we have all the knowledge in the world, we can still not have our heart guarded. We can still disobey, even though we know what's right and wrong. You know, and so this is our lesson. I mean, Solomon learned a lot, didn't he? When he got to the end of his life, he said, look, it's all vanity. Guard your heart. That's what he's telling his sons, to guard it. Don't just give it away so cheaply and freely to yourself or to someone else. So, anything, any questions?
Started reading a book this morning, actually, and it said in there, when you just acquire knowledge and you don't do it, what happens is you think you're spiritual because of what you know. And then knowledge puffs up, and then what comes before a fall? Pride. You know, and it just really spoke to me, and I couldn't help but think of Solomon, but also myself at times, where we got to be really careful, guys, especially you guys from Pure Life. You know, I say this because you get like a, it's kind of like a deluge of truth for whatever, 6 to 9 months, and you got to be careful that all that knowledge you've gotten doesn't make you believe like you've achieved something, but yet you're not living it out in your life. I warn you, don't do that, you know, and don't think you're more spiritual than somebody else because you just know more stuff. Make sure you're applying it to your life. That's what I learned from Solomon's life.
Yeah,